If you're gay, then you're gay. Don't pretend that you're straight. You could be who you are any day of the week. You are unlike the others, so strong and unique. We're all with you.
If you're straight, well, that's great. You can help procreate and make gay little babies for the whole human race. Make a world we can live in where the one who you love's not an issue. 'Cause we're all somewhere in the middle. We're all just looking for love to change the world. And we're all here in it together.
Thanks for tuning in, and welcome to the April 13th, 2020, Shelter in Place edition of IMRU Radio Magazine. Hello, I'm Michael Taylor Gray. Since we're all still social distancing this week, we revisit a very special Gaytino report, Steve Pride's talk with Call Me By Your Name author Andre Aciman, then Pride on Screen takes a look at two LGBT movies to stream this week, Dallas Buyers Club and God's Own Country. But first, some honest tea. It's with a heavy heart here on Honest Tea that we mourn the passing of a famed, iconic LGBTQ activist, Phyllis Lyon. Phyllis Lyon spent more than 50 years fighting for LGBTQ rights, and she died of natural causes at the age of 95. This is reported from CNN, reported by Leah Asmalash and Don Pasentino, on Thursday, April 9th, 2020. When Governor Gavin Newsom was serving as mayor of San Francisco, he officiated the wedding between Phyllis Lyon and her late partner, Del Martin, in 2008. Del Martin later passed in that same year. And on Twitter, Governor Newsom wrote, "Phyllis and Del were the manifestation of love and devotion. Yet for over 50 years, they were denied the right to say two extraordinary words, I do. Phyllis, it was the honor of a lifetime to marry you and Del. Your courage changed the course of history. Rest in peace, my dear friend." The couple founded the Daughters of Bilitis, the first lesbian rights organization in the United States, in 1955. And both Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon, who just passed, are considered champions of the LGBTQ rights movement. Our next story is a fine example of how the hypocritical apple doesn't fall far from the hypocritical apple tree. From LGBTQNation.com, Thursday, April 9th, 2020, reported by Bill Browning, Jerry Falwell Jr. has an arrest warrant for reporters who wrote about COVID-19 at his school. Jerry Falwell Jr., who is an ardent Donald Trump supporter and the president of the conservative Christian Liberty University in Virginia, which I almost applied to after graduating high school. I kid you not. He's attempting to press charges against two journalists, issuing two arrest warrants for misdemeanor trespassing for a New York Times photographer and a ProPublica reporter. And now the two journalists were working on two separate stories. And Falwell also attempted to bring charges against the author of the New York Times article as well, but a magistrate didn't find enough evidence to charge her. Now, the school had posted no trespassing signs at every entrance, according to Jerry Falwell Jr., a measure that he said that the school claimed would limit coronavirus on a campus when the school reopened during the epidemic. New York Times attorney David McCraw said in a statement, and I quote, "Photographer Julia Rendleman was engaged in the most routine form of news gathering, taking an outdoors picture of a person who was interviewed for a news story. We are disappointed that Liberty University would decide to make that into a criminal case and go after a freelance journalist because its officials were unhappy with press coverage of the university's decision to convene classes in the midst of the pandemic." Now, while Falwell has insisted that he had the okay and go-ahead from local government and medical professionals to get thousands of students back into cramped dormitories, cafeterias, and recreation centers, and then the students started to get sick. According to the New York Times, the doctor that Liberty University claims gave the go-ahead and the school's medical staff and the mayor of Lynchburg, Virginia, have all denied that they gave Jerry Falwell Jr. the okay to bring students back on campus. About half of the 1,900 students who returned to campus have fled the dormitories. Now, Falwell denies the allegations, and the doctor who was quoted by the New York Times has retracted his comments. And to make sure that Jerry Falwell Jr. doesn't feel alone in his hypocritical apple orchard, we bring you another story from LGBTQ Nation from Friday, April 10th, 2020, reported by Alex Bollinger. Donald Trump picks anti-LGBTQ Fox News producer as new press secretary. She said, "Trans rights will lead women to getting attacked in bathrooms," that old chestnut, "that marriage equality will close down religious institutions," that hasn't happened, "and that Mike Pence loves LGBTQ people." No evidence of that anywhere. Last week, former Fox News and CNN producer Kayleigh McEnany, 31, was picked by Trump as his fourth press secretary following the ouster of Stephanie Grisham, who didn't hold a single press conference during her nine-month tenure. But don't despair for Stephanie Grisham. Unlike millions of us who've lost their jobs due to the coronavirus, she's returned to the staff of the First Lady to continue her work there. We wish you luck. McEnany, who sometimes wrote columns for conservative websites and appeared on CNN as a commentator, is also known for her unfailing loyalty to Trump and his administration. Defending the Trump administration over the last few years has also meant defending their anti-LGBTQ policy. In 2017, McEnany said that anti-discrimination measures for transgender people would lead to straight men coming in and really being a predator against women. Now, she defended the Trump administration's decision to move Obama-era transgender protections, stating that the only reason it was happening was deference to the states, but not explaining why transgender people in different states should have different rights. She further cited that voyeurism issues could be utilized by some men, for instance, to go into female bathrooms, claiming that this has happened at Target once. No details, but it happened at Target once, she said. She also defended Vice President Mike Pence when CNN host Don Lemon said that Pence opposes LGBTQ rights. "Mike Pence loves all people," and then-President-elect Donald Trump has already said he's not going to roll back the rights that we've seen in the gay community. And we know how that's worked out. Now, she hasn't only honed in on LGBTQ rights as an ardent Trump supporter. She's been hammering at marriage equality for years. McEnany dismissed LGBTQ activists' arguments as a lot of farcical blabber about state-sanctioned discrimination. To McEnany, marriage equality was entirely about states' rights because it's not discrimination when states do it. From there, her arguments digressed even further to insist that religious institutions would be forced to perform same-sex marriages, a common argument used by conservatives at the time, to make people feel afraid that LGBTQ equality would close churches. But why stop at demeaning and diminishing LGBTQ plus rights? Why not attack the modern woman as well? On Modern Women Today, she says the feminists of today are the equivalent of the whining rich kid whose parents toiled through some great pains to provide them with a future they can't respect or cherish because they have no grasp of real repression, real struggle, and real liberation. Contemporary feminism looks a lot more like attention-seeking shallow cowardice. I present to you Kayleigh McEnany, our new press secretary. Our next story comes to us from Advocate.com, reported by Jeffrey Masters, April 10th, 2020. Trans politician Christine Hallquist tests positive for COVID-19. Christine Hallquist, the transgender woman who ran for governor of Vermont in 2018, has tested positive for COVID-19. She was tested Sunday, April 5th, and received confirmation on April 10th that the test was positive. "I do have the virus. It has been a brutal week of illness. I think I may be through the worst of it. This is my first day fever-free in a week," Hallquist wrote on Facebook. Now one of the most high-profile members of the trans community to test positive, Christine Hallquist made history in 2018 as the first out transgender politician to be a major party nominee for governor in the United States. A registered Democrat, she lost the general election to incumbent Republican Phil Scott. Before going into politics, she had a long career in the energy industry. She was CEO of the Vermont Electric Cooperative, where she became the first business leader in the U.S. to transition while on the job. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention now recommends all people wear cloth face coverings in public settings, especially in areas like grocery stores and pharmacies, where social distancing measures are difficult to maintain. The CDC notes that cloth face masks are not the same thing as surgical masks or N95 respirators, which should still be reserved for healthcare workers. And that's the honest tea. Andre Aciman is the author of Call Me By Your Name, which was made into a swoon-worthy hit movie. So what inspired a straight man to write such a romantic queer story? Steve Pride reports.
This is Steve Pride giving you Pride Out Loud from the Beverly Hilton Hotel in Beverly Hills, where I'm talking with Call Me By Your Name novelist Andre Aciman. Are you stunned by the success of the film?
Totally stunned. I never expected it. I never thought it would happen. And even when they told me they were making a movie, I still didn't believe it was going to happen.
What do you think of the movie as opposed to the vision you had in your head as an author? I know it's difficult to say, oh, that's not how I saw it.
Yeah, because I saw it happening on the shore of Italy. And this happens in a landlocked area near Milan. But it doesn't matter. I mean, I was very happy with the film. The house that I imagined was a different house. This house is absolutely the most fitting house that I could ever have pictured. So it has given me images that I never had as a writer.
Gay men especially have like embraced this. At a function I was at, someone mentioned that they thought it was a good film, but, and the second they say but, there was almost like boos. People wanted to rip them apart. They're so taken by this film, they're obsessed with it, in fact.
Everybody's obsessed by it, and I think most people see it many, many times, and they read the book many times, which is something that I never do, but apparently it has hit a particular kind of mark and made a mark on people's lives, and I still have a hard time figuring out what precisely it is. In most cases, it's the love that could have been and never happened, or it's the love that many people who are so young hope to find in their lives.
You're a heterosexual man. I know this is a cliche question now. You've probably been getting it a lot. Where did this come from?
I don't know. I have no idea where it came from. But once I got started on the gay theme, I couldn't let it go. And it was totally, totally riveting and exciting. I fell in love with the characters. I fell in love with each one, with their love, with everything. And clearly, obviously, something is going on inside of me that goes in that direction. But I have no idea where it came from.
The speech that the father makes at the end of the film was almost word for word from the book.
Yes, and that was extremely gratifying for my vanity. But I think that the speech, the way it was delivered, was... I never read the speech again when I give a public reading because it's so well done by Michael Stuhlbarg that I will not touch it again. It is the best thing, I think, besides Timothy at the very end, the best thing of the film.
I almost walked out at the end without, and I thought, they're still going.
Yes, that is probably the most magical moment and most enchanting and heartbreaking moment is that you see the face and you see the face and you see the face and you don't think much about it until suddenly you see the credits and you realize that, oh my God, the film is over. This story is over. It's finished. It's ended. This is very sad. And that's exactly how I felt, and I think most people feel more poignantly, because I'm the author, I know how the story ends, but most people are surprised and almost sort of smitten by the whole experience of, not now, I could use another 5 minutes of this film, this story.
Actually, it goes on. There's a sequel going to be filmed, correct?
They're talking about a sequel. They're talking about many sequels, because they want to trace the sort of the trajectory of their lives through the years, very much the way that the Truffaut did with Antoine Doinel, and that's Luca Guadagnino's project. Whether it comes about or not, I don't know. We discuss possible sort of plot lines.
But they didn't use the whole book, so there's still more story in your book they can tell.
There is more. I mean, I think half of the book was left out. But it's not germane to the actual story because the rest is just after love or after years. And I don't think that there's a plot there, really, to be honest. I mean, there's a trip to Rome, but the trip to Rome is just a long, Fellini-esque sort of adventure. But there's nothing going on between the two that is any different from what happened before.
Is there any moment in the film when you're watching it that you, like, exclaim to yourself, that's it, they got that moment so right?
Oh, that happened many, many times. When he goes into the bedroom and sort of tries the bathing suit, that was not exactly as in the book, but that's the same idea. And finally, when they both speak about the possibility of something happening between them, though they do not name it, nevertheless, it's so oblique and yet at the same time so clear. That was perfect. And it was right out of the book.
I'm going to imagine that when you go out, people must give you peaches.
All the time. I think the peach has become the equivalent of Proust's Madeleine. People always come up and give me peaches. They give me ceramic peaches. They give me sort of images of peaches that they've drawn on the internet. I get peaches all the time. It's a token of affection now.
What do you hope people take away from your book and the movie?
I want them to experience love, of course. I want them to say, this is what love is. But I also want them, if there is a message, and I'm always hesitant to suggest that there is one, is not just of tolerance, but I hope that parent-child relationships be improved significantly so that if a child is gay, he should see that there's a model out there, there's a solution out there, and that a father, if he has a son who is gay, he should absolutely make it possible for the son to speak, if the son is reluctant to. Basically, it's be open, address the issue. It's okay now.
And I know you did film festivals a little bit. What was the feedback you got from people?
A lot of people say that it changed their lives, and I'm such a jerk that I always say, how did it do that? And it turns out that they don't know. They don't have an answer.
This is Steve Pride giving you Pride Out Loud from the Beverly Hilton Hotel in Beverly Hills, where I've been talking with Call Me By Your Name novelist, Andre Osterman. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Swoon-worthy indeed. I know the movie itself was controversial in some respects, but the scene with the son and the father, I'd never seen that on screen before, and it just broke my heart. To see a son be able to have that kind of heart-to-heart conversation with his father, you just don't see that enough on screen. So I hope we get more from Andre Osterman. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this quick break.
Phyllis Lyon and Del Martin, pioneers in lesbian liberation, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Phyllis Lyon and Del Martin met in 1950 in Seattle. Despite the socially conservative era, their bond grew, and in 1953, they moved to San Francisco together. 2 years later, they and six of their friends founded the first national organization for lesbians in the U.S. called the Daughters of Bilitis. At first a social club for lesbians, it quickly became the lifeblood of the lesbian movement. Del was the first president, and Phyllis was editor for their newsletter called The Ladder. In 1972, the couple published their most significant book, Lesbian Woman, which chronicled lesbian life in modern America. And in 2004, after more than 50 years of working to legitimize lesbian love and commitment, Phyllis and Del were married in San Francisco. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Brenda Thornton.
Hello, I'm Barney Frank, and you were listening to IMRU Radio Magazine, out front and out loud since 1974.
IMRU.
Well, what kind of bar is this? Why aren't there any women in here? It's a lot. It's a gay bar. Well, hell, I've had a little fun with the fellas now and then, but you know, if you're gonna have a bar, you gotta have ladies. Well, of course you can buy me a drink. That was.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Taylor Gray. Since we're all still on lockdown, we've rustled up not one, but two Pride on Screen films to stream. First is God's Own Country. Steve Pride spoke to the director and star of the film to get the 411.
God's Own Country is a stunning gay love story of both brutality and tenderness, set in the rustic hills of West Yorkshire in the UK.
I'm Francis Lee, and I am the writer and director of God's Own Country.
My name is Alex Carano, and I'm an actor. I'm one of the two leads in God's Own Country.
God's Own Country is primarily about Johnny Saxby, who is a Yorkshire sheep farmer, and he is running the farm on his own because his father's had a stroke and his grandma's quite old. All his friends have moved away to university or college or got jobs in towns, so he's very isolated, very lonely. He's shut down emotionally to be able to continue the work and keep the farm going. It comes to spring, and all the sheep are going to give birth to their lambs, and he can't do it on his own, so his father employs a Romanian migrant worker who's in the UK looking for work to come and help him, and it becomes about their relationship.
What inspired this?
The starting point for the film was the landscape, really. So I grew up on the hills in Yorkshire. I left when I was 20. I escaped to London to train as an actor. But I could never get that landscape out of my head. It felt to have totally informed who I was emotionally and physically. And so when I was thinking about stopping acting and making film, it just felt like a place that I had to investigate, that I had to explore, and also to represent those people that I knew so well from that area. I've only been making film for about 5 years. I got to a certain point in my career as an actor where I was very dissatisfied. I'd fallen out of love with it years before. I wasn't doing work that I felt was challenging. I always wanted to tell stories, and I had always seen the world visually. I'd been an obsessive stills photographer, but I'd never been confident enough to actually say that or to sit down and write anything. And I got to a certain age and thought, I'm going to have to do something. So I gave up acting. I got a job in a junkyard and started to write. And I wrote 3 short films and self-financed those by the job in the junkyard. And while I was doing that, I had this idea. I was exploring this idea of landscape, as I said, and the people who live on this hillside that I know so well. And so I wrote God's Own Country on spec. I just sat down and wrote it. And I just wanted to show the world a little bit of how I see my world.
Alec, when you first read the script, what connected with you?
Why did you want to do this movie? It sounds like a lot of work.
I think it was one of the most detailed scripts that I've ever read. Every single glimpse and every single gesture that you can see in the film, it was written in the script. That made me really connect with the characters and with the story, and it's a very beautiful and powerful story. Of course, after I read the script, I really wanted to meet Francis, and I got a chance when he came to Bucharest to audition to see 14 or 13 Romanian actors. And we worked together for half an hour, 45 minutes, and I really understood that he knew what he wants from this story and from this film.
How did you prepare them for what was not just acting, but some very difficult and specific farm work?
I worked with both Josh and Alec, who played the leads in the film, for about 3 months before the shoot. And we worked primarily on the characters in that period. We started from the moment they were born until the moment we meet them in the film. And we worked through everything, not just on a timeline, but also in terms of relationships, family relationships, friends. Every single little detail about these men we discovered and we learnt and we worked on. Right down to if they had sugar in their tea, what socks they preferred, everything. So by the time we got to the actual shoot and Alec and Josh came to the set, they were totally immersed in their characters. So then for 2 weeks before we started the shoot, I sent them to work on farms because I knew I never wanted a stunt double or a hand double. I never wanted to be pulled out of this film with fakery. So both actors went and worked on 2 separate farms, and they worked long, solid shifts. And they would start early in the morning and they would end their shift late at night, and they learnt to do everything. They learnt how to birth lambs. They learned how to build walls. I mean, they literally learned everything. It was really important to me that they embodied these characters both physically and emotionally. And there's such a impact that working that way has on somebody physically. They got cold, they got wet, they got miserable. And these were all great things for me because that's what the characters were going through. So again, by the time it came to shooting the scenes when they had to do the farm stuff, both of them were totally proficient, as if they'd been doing it their whole entire lives. So everything you see in the film is totally for real.
You shot this chronologically too. Explain why.
The script very much felt like each scene acted like building blocks in this relationship. I love actors, and I will do anything I can to support them, to get the very best out of them, and to facilitate their work. And so it felt really important to me that if I could shoot chronologically, that would really help the development of their relationship. It also added this extra benefit. The way in which the film is structured, Alec's character, Georgi, isn't there at the beginning of the film. So I could keep them apart. And as people, Josh and Alec wouldn't get to know each other very well. So they wouldn't have developed that comfortable kind of relationship. And for me, that was going to translate on screen. So the first time they meet on screen, not completely, but it was almost the first time they kind of had worked together. So there was that extra layer of kind of tension or nervousness that I thought would just add a little bit of extra something in the scene. Once the relationship between the two boys develops, I move them both into the same house and they built this beautiful, lovely, caring friendship between them. And again, that translated onto screen. So anything I could do to enable that, to make it feel richer and deeper, I did.
As an actor, did filming in this way make it easier or more difficult?
No, it's a lot easier. I mean, you can't find this kind of work with many directors. And it was incredible to work on this film. I mean, all the process that we had and all the things that we had to do and working on farms and developing our characters from scratch and discussing about them and knowing their lives from the point they were born until we see them on screen. And this is the way I want to work and this is the way I love to work. And Francis did an amazing job in creating this environment and letting these things happen.
At one point in the film, you put your arm inside a cow and later you birth a sheep.
Yeah.
At least now, though, you have something to fall back on if this acting thing doesn't work out.
Yeah, yeah.
I think Alec will be fine in the acting world. I'm hoping, and I know, he isn't going to need anything to fall back on.
God's Own Country is being called the UK Brokeback Mountain.
I'm really super flattered by the Brokeback comparisons. I think it's a masterpiece in storytelling, and Ang Lee is an incredible storyteller. And those are phenomenal performances at the heart of it. I think this film is different, and I think you've hit the nail on the head. I think Brokeback is about sexuality. It's about society's attitude towards sexuality at that very specific time. Whereas I do think this film is more about love and about the human condition, which feels slightly more universal, maybe.
This has been a conversation with writer-director Francis Lee and actor Alec Saccarano about their film, God's Own Country. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Francis Lee's directorial debut delivers such a stunning love story that at times is just pure poetry. God's Own Country is available to stream on Netflix and Amazon Prime. Our second film is Dallas Buyers Club, and Steve Pride spoke with the film stars Matthew McConaughey and Jared Leto.
Set during the early days of the AIDS plague, Dallas Buyers Club is about Ron Woodruff, a homophobic redneck Texan who was diagnosed with the HIV virus and given 30 days to live. It's the story of his unwillingness to go gently into that good night and the personal growth he experiences along the way.
You've tested positive for HIV, which is the virus that causes AIDS.
You kidding me? I'm with that Rocky Hudson bullshit.
Mr. Woodruff, have you ever used intravenous drugs? Have you ever engaged in homosexual conduct?
Homo. Did you say homo?
Yeah.
That's what she said, isn't it? You kidding me? I ain't no faggot. I don't even know no faggot. Look at me. What do you see, huh? The damn rodeo is what you see.
Ron Woodruff is played with raw fury and grace by Matthew McConaughey.
Ron Woodruff, man with a seventh grade education, electrician / part-time bull rider. Don't leave your wallet sitting around because he'll probably steal from it. A womanizing, fun, hell-raising son of a bitch who's heterosexual and gets HIV, given 30 days to live. Guy becomes a scientist of HIV, leaves the borders and goes out amongst the world to go out and research and bring back anything he can. And he's not only bringing it back to just survive, he wants to, he's gonna make him some money. So he's got a bit of Scarface to him too. Businessman who unknowingly becomes an activist as well. Without ever sort of consciously raising that flag and saying, I'm the leader, he kind of becomes that without even really knowing it. He really only found purpose in his life when he got HIV. He found the one thing that he could grab a hold of and fight for every single day, every minute of the day. And he was never going to lay down and go, whoa, be me. He was not going to fade away. And what did he do? If you look at the film, or what I think his legacy would be, he's a guy who I think shook the tree enough to where it's possible that the FDA has approved certain drugs that have worked for HIV sooner than maybe they would have. Because he was a bit of a thorn in their side, enough where they wanted to shut him down and keep him quiet.
The entrepreneurial Woodruff joined forces with an unlikely band of renegades and outcasts, people he once would have shunned, including a transgendered prostitute named Rayon, brilliantly embodied by Jared Leto.
I'm Rayon.
Congratulations. Go back to your bed.
Relax, I don't bite. I guess you're handsome in a Texas hick, white trash, dumb kind of way.
Get out of here, whatever you are, before I kick you in the face.
My character in the film is the lovely Rayon. So it's Texas, it's 1985. You've got this cowboy and this young man who has chosen to live as a woman, a really brave choice. I couldn't imagine how terrifying it must have been to walk through a grocery store at that time. I met with somebody earlier that said he got teased and almost beat up for wearing an OP shirt in 1985. I couldn't imagine a wig and high heels. So I had a lot of respect. I have a lot of respect for people that make that choice. And Rayon just kept surprising me. Sense of humor, the street smarts, the passion, the empathy. She's a survivor, and it was really special to be involved with this project. And I thought there was a real opportunity here to portray a real person, not a cliche or a stereotype.
I mean, they're two great characters. I mean, it's just the odd couple. It's the odd couple love story, and not in a sexual way, but just it's two outsiders coming together and two people from two completely different sides of the track that this disease and sort of by predicament brought them together. And the relationship starts out. Ron despises his kind, but as a businessman, that guy's my in. Or that, as Ron would say, that it is my in. You know, that's my way into my business, people that'll buy my product. And then, you know, through that, and as it happens, through that, when you go through some real life together and through some really hard times, you see Ron, you know, starts to give a damn, wants him to take better care of himself.
Woodruff established a buyer's club, distributing unapproved but promising drugs to people with AIDS. The film details his motivational shift from profit to passion as the government fights to shut him down.
You're only allowed to bring in a 90-day supply.
Yes. As I was telling the gentleman earlier, I'm a sick man. I take 33 pills a day. This is my 90-day supply.
You do realize that importing illegal drugs for sale, it's a very serious offense.
Well, of course it is. And as I said, they're not for sale, nor are they illegal, merely unapproved.
And the one thing actor Matthew McConaughey wants to be sure you know about Dallas Buyers Club.
We got an independent film with less than $5 million. Okay, those films are always going to be, or an attempt to be, good medicine, right? Kind of something that you know you probably should go see and it's going to be good for you, and you know what I mean? But a lot of times, if they work and they are good medicine, they're not usually
that much fun or that entertaining. I think we got away with going, we got some good medicine that also tastes good and is fun and it's rock and roll. And the humor actually brings forth the humanity, that we didn't go deep into the hardcore sentiment, actually allows the story to come out, actually allows the crusader and the fight and the cause to emerge. And that's something I'm proud that we consciously did. John Mark and I tried to keep tallies on that throughout. And he would say, are we going too far with this guy? And I was like, I think we can trust this, that the humanity and the sympathy and the understanding for the overall cause will emerge if we stick with who this guy is all the way through and don't pull back and go, well, it's act three. He needs to become a super nice guy. Uh-uh. You know, he can become more understanding. He can become more tolerant. He can be like, you know what, man? Sell the car. That's still him, you know? There's devil may care in that too, but he never became the guy on the steps going, I'm going to lead us to, you know? And that's part of the beauty of the guy, because he was never conscious like that.
And once you've seen it, what does director Jean-Marc Vallée hope you take away from the film?
The life lesson.
The life lesson, I think that's why I got involved with this project. This guy, when you're being told you got 30 days to live, oh yeah, you watch me. And there's nothing out there that can kill me in 30 days. This is the ultimate message.
Mr. Woodruff, I know this can be a very scary thing. I know you're probably feeling overwhelmed right now. But what we would like to do is to impress upon you the gravity of your situation. Based on your health, based on your condition, based on all the evidence we have, we estimate you have 30 days left to put your affairs in order.
Let me give you a little news flash. There ain't nothing out there can kill Ron Woodruff in 30 days.
Ron Woodruff died of AIDS on September 12, 1992, 7 years, or some 2,557 days, after he was given 30 days to live. This has been a conversation with Matthew McConaughey, Jared Leto, and Jean-Marc Vallée. Dallas Buyers Club is a Focus Features release. I'm Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Jared Leto has always been one of my favorite actors. It's kind of been under the radar, but his work in Dallas Buyers Club was just heart-wrenching. Make sure you see it. Dallas Buyers Club is available to stream on Netflix and available to rent on Amazon Prime.
The Daughters of Bilitis, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. 14 years before the Stonewall Riots, the first national lesbian organization was formed in San Francisco, taking up the cause for civil rights. It was called the Daughters of Bilitis. The group was founded by 8 women, including lesbian couple Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon. Martin served as its first president, and in 1956, Lyon started the group's national lesbian monthly magazine called The Ladder. With local chapters forming in the 50s and 60s, the group hosted public forums on homosexuality, managed research projects, and offered support to lesbians at risk. But in the 70s, with members split over whether to focus on gay rights or feminism, the national group practically disappeared. Yet, to its credit, the group had fostered an understanding of lesbian lives and paved the way for the fight ahead. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Brenda Thornton.
Hi, I'm Amanda Burse, and you're listening to IMRU Radio Magazine, out front and out loud since 1974.
It's a pleasure to meet you, Leo. It's an honor. You're one of, Hollywood's brightest young stars. I have to say I really liked you in that boat movie. I was wondering if maybe you'd like to come back to my place. I think you're kind of pretty. What do you mean you're not interested? You can't say no to me. I'm Jimmy Stewart. I'm a movie star. You don't say no to Jimmy Stewart, you stupid little pretty boy. what Jimmy Stewart wants, Jimmy Stewart gets. Got it?
Welcome back. I'm Michael Taylor Gray. And now, like Jell-O, there's always room for a gay Tino report. And tonight, Dan Guerrero explores the denizens of mariachi at Juarez de Los Angeles, L.A.'s only LGBT mariachi band.
Bienvenidos. Welcome to the Gaytino Report, voices from the Latino LGBTQ community. I'm Dan Guerrero, or if you can roll your R's, Guerrero. Today, Carlos Samaniego, the leader of the first and only LGBT mariachi on the planet, well, that we know of, and his star vocalist Natalia Melendez, who can belt out a ranchera with the best of them. Together, a cosmic friendship between a gay man and a transgender woman, set against the macho culture of the mariachi. Ooh, that sounds like a juicy novella. First up, Carlos Samaniego. He grew up in El Sereno with early dreams of being an opera singer. He studied in New York and Italy before slipping into a charro outfit to create and head up the appropriately named Mariachi Arco Iris de Los Angeles, the Rainbow Mariachi of Los Angeles. Hey, Carlos. Thanks
Hi.
For being here. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Good, good, good. Let's cut to the chase. Why an LGBTQ mariachi?
Well, I decided to create this group so that people who identify as LGBTQ within the mariachi world have a safe haven to get together, rehearse, and perform this wonderful music from Mexico.
Did you find that as an LGBT person, it was not terribly comfortable to be in the traditional mariachi?
I found that very much the case, yes. Throughout my years playing mariachi, and I've been doing mariachi since I was a teenager, I've encountered good and bad experiences. The bad experiences really have caused me to want to create this group. Basically, I had been the victim of bullying and being made fun of and people talking behind my back or straight to my face in regards to the fact that I was an out mariachi. Or, you know, mariachi isn't even in the equation, just that I was out and working alongside these people. And I decided that I had enough of that, and I thought that other people may be going through the same thing. And I thought, well, we need somewhere to perform and to do this where we're free of all of that kind of negativity.
Actually, you told me that the idea started on a whim while you were at Cal State.
Right. So I attended Cal State LA from 1998 until 2002. And around my second year of college, I came out of the closet. I came way out. I flew out and I wanted to join any gay organization that I could find. And I joined a men's group at the Wall of Memorias project in Highland Park. And I joined the Campus Gay and Lesbian Alliance. And we were planning our Pride events for that year. And at the time, of course, same-sex marriage was not legal. And one of the events for that organization was a mock wedding in protest for same-sex marriages. And so in planning these events, we thought, okay, we do have a budget. Let's bring a mariachi for the wedding. And since Cal State LA is a very Latino campus, we thought, well, yep, that makes sense. And then it dawned on me, wait a minute, wouldn't it be great if I could make it an all-gay mariachi? And everyone just went, can you do that? Is that possible? So I actually had to stop for a moment and think, wait, do I know enough gay people in the mariachi world to get this going? And I did. I found people, and people helped me find other people, and people came in from out of town to do the one gig. And that's when Mariachi Arco Iris de Los Angeles began originally in the year 2000. The mariachi continued for a while until it dissipated maybe about 8 or 9 months later. I was really young, very inexperienced, didn't know how to really lead a mariachi. And then Mariachi Arco Iris came back into existence in 2014.
Is there a difference from the traditional mariachi community today as opposed to 2000? Things have changed somewhat, or do you find you guys are still separate and in your own little world as a LGBTQ group?
Unfortunately, the mariachi world really has not accepted us fully. We really don't get invited into the mariachi conferences or the mariachi festivals. However, on the flip side, we do have our special niche, and there are people who hire us because of who we are, what we represent, what we do. And I feel that that's really special because people now hire us where they otherwise would never have considered hiring a mariachi. Lots of Pride events, just so many of these events where they would have never considered showcasing a mariachi. Mm-hmm. Why? Mm-hmm. But now that this mariachi exists, there's a reason.
Okay, hang out a second because I want to bring on our next guest and then we'll chat together. Natalia Melendez, that's such a pretty name, comes from a family of musicians. So it was no big surprise she was playing the violin by the time she was 8 and singing at age 10. And it was always mariachi for her, no opera for her. It was always the mariachi. Actually, for him, because Natalia was born Julio. Hola, Natalia.
Hi, Dan. How are you?
I'm good. I wish they could see how pretty you are, but it's radio.
Well, thank you.
Your story is so fascinating. Where to begin? Where to begin? So, you literally grew up in children's mariachis as a kid.
Yeah, I grew up playing violin at the age of 8 years old. The first time I seen mariachi, I just gravitated to it. And the violinist that was playing by the name of Laura Sobrino, She was the one that I was mesmerized by. And it was actually at a family party in my home. Oh. And I was just, something clicked within me. And my uncle was in the mariachi. He was a guitarron player. And after that gig, I was literally, you could see a home video of me off to the side with my grandparents and everybody. And I'm just there for the whole time the group plays. Wow. That was when something triggered in me and I wanted to play violin like that lady.
One moment can change your whole life, right?
That's exactly what it is.
There are actually mariachi conferences all over the Southwest where they train young children. And I love that the tradition continues. They like their Beyonce, they like their Café Tacuba, but they love their mariachi as well.
Right?
It's so important to keep that tradition going.
Yeah, I believe so. When I was young, I started in the Heritage Society, which was with José Hernández.
Sol de México.
With Sol de México, right. And Laura was doing the classes there. And then we had Curita Iriberto Molina from Mariachi Vargas that was a vocal instructor. And we literally had a schedule when we were young. If we were in Juvenil Sol de México, we had to do vocal lessons with Curita. And then we would do our music learning with Laura. Oh. And that's what I started when I was young.
And it paid off. You're still young, by the way.
I think so, too. Thank you.
Now, Carlos mentioned that one of the reasons he formed Arcoiris was to create a safe space for LGBTQ out musicians. But I would suspect that the macho mentality of that world would have been especially difficult for the young Julio.
Oh, it was extremely difficult for me. I was actually living in a bubble for so many years, dealing with identity issues, dealing with looking like a young male and not feeling like a male and wanting to be a part of a mariachi world and in a group. And it was very, very difficult. I learned very young at an early age what it was all about to be closeted and not to be accepted as a gay male back then. At a very young age, I knew that I couldn't be out. It just wasn't accepted.
Well, you were actually double closeted.
I was. But you know what? I'm a little rebel. So through time, I kind of didn't care what people were going to say. So then I started tweezing my eyebrows. I was pretty out there. You know, I was like, I got to be me. But being me, I really was not being me because I was being a gay boy, young man.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm a transgender female. So, you know, when I was growing up with the girls that I grew up with, like Nidia Rojas and Lucero and a lot of these big people that are amazing musicians now, I wanted to be them.
Yeah.
We would be in lessons together. And I'm like, why can't I look like them? Why can't I sing like them? I want to be a badass musician like them. You know, so it was kind of like, wow, I'm living as Julio, but I'm not happy. I'm not really who I am.
But you knew who you were.
And I surely
just the world had to be ready for it. And you just punched your way through.
I sure did.
That's very brave. I mean, that's very brave.
But there was a lot of repercussions because of it, you know.
I'm sure.
There was a lot.
But look at you now. Look at you now.
Yes.
Was there a actual moment when you decided to make the full transition, or was it just cumulative, or was there one day you said, all right, enough already?
Yeah, enough was enough. I was in my late 20s, and I just had enough. I lived because of my, not to veer away from what we were discussing, but I'm a recovering addict. That was due to me being a closeted transgender woman. You know, I was fighting with identity issues. So I clinged on to a drug, but I had enough. I lived a crazy life. I was tired. I didn't want to live another day and walk this earth not being sober and not living in my true authentic self. I had enough to about 27. And I just got my life, so to speak, excuse my language, by the balls. And I did what I had to do. And I left LA. I actually put myself in a Christian home for 1 year, away from family, away from friends, no communication with anybody. I said, Lord Jesus, I surrender myself to you, whether I am to be a male and to live with a woman, I'm here. I'm going to do everything that I have to do that. I was doing internal cleaning inside my soul. And I said, or you let me know that the woman that I truly feel I am inside is okay, and that I can get over this addiction so that when I do come out to the real world, I can be a productive citizen in life and I could be a happy person internally. And you know, that was the year that changed my life. So I come back home to Los Angeles and I start looking for work besides mariachi, and things just started working. I was just going full force. It's like you put a full tank of gas in a car and you go. That's what I did. When I came back to LA, I was loaded and I went.
I'm speechless for a minute here. That's a fantastic. You got to write your book. Come back, Carlos. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
I know that you also told me that Natalia was hugely helpful to you when you came out. You came out young, but she's the one that dragged you out, kicking and screaming.
I tried to kick him out.
Yeah, thanks. Yes, I met Natalia when she was still Julio back in 1997, approximately. And we were in this youth group, and I was clearly not out at that time. And Julio, or Jay, what we used to call him, he definitely was. And so I really respected Jay as a musician because Natalia is such an amazing musician. And I was just getting started. I had up to that point really had only played guitarrón, and I was switching to violin. So I really looked up to Natalia for that guidance. And I just really admired Jay's playing. And I really remember going over to his house to practice. And he was always very welcoming and the same person that Natalia is now.
You guys pretty much the same age?
We're the same age. We're only a few months apart.
Okay.
And so he helped me a great deal to grow as a musician. Mm-hmm. And then as it turns out, also just as a person, because the more I saw him being himself, so to speak, I thought later to myself, that's okay for me too.
It gave you strength.
Yeah, and it helped me to find out who I am and that it's okay. And Jay was always very much there for me and just my, you know, my sibling.
It's fascinating because in the first incarnation of Arcoguiris, you were with Julio. And now in this current version, you're with Natalia.
Correct.
And yes. How is that different for each of you?
She has breasts. Yeah, so this is what I love about Natalia. She's the same person that I met when we were teenagers. The fact that she's changed the way she looks, everything else is exactly the same. And so thank God for that, because she's just such an amazing person, and I'm just so grateful.
Oh, I love you, brother.
I love you too.
Well, doesn't anybody love me?
We love you too, Dan.
Okay, so your dream is to perform at one of the big mariachi concert events like the one at the Hollywood Bowl, and to record your first album, which I know is in the works, and to play in Mexico, right?
Yes, absolutely. We need to be displayed, so to speak. Our talents are here, and we want to be made known that we exist, not only so that we can perform and show how well we play, but also because we serve, as it turns out, as an example to our community. And I've been told this. People have been messaging me and Natalia saying, hey, I can't believe you exist. I wish something like that existed here where I'm from. Or, you know, some guy in some pueblo in Mexico has said, because of you, I decided to come out to my family, and I'm a mariachi too, where I play and live. And so all of these things are very powerful. It's amazing to perform for our community, and that's who we're here for. But if we can be seen also on a bigger platform for a bigger, broader audience, then we're serving our community more that way. That's why we want to do that. And performing in Mexico is just a dream, because this is where the music's from. Mexico is the home of mariachi. And so for us to go and show an LGBTQ mariachi,
a U.S. one,
yes,
a Chicano one.
Exactly. To go and show them that we can perform the music just as well as anyone else can from Mexico, and we're queer, I think that's very powerful, and I think they would appreciate it as well.
And Mexico City has a huge gay pride event. I mean, it's a week long or something. Yeah. Just remember, dreams do come true. You just got to keep dreaming. You're listening to The Gaytino Report with Dan Guerrero. I'm talking with Carlos Amaniego and Natalia Melendez from the Mariachi Arcoiris de Los Angeles. Thank you, Carlos and Natalia, for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Hasta pronto. See you all later.
Well, that's the end of our show. Our thanks to IMRU's executive producer Steve Pride and Rainbow Minute producers Judd Proctor and Brian Burns. Find us online at imruradio.org and follow us on Facebook at IMRU Radio. If you are a web designer, social media expert, or just interested in LGBTQI community affairs and would like to volunteer with IMRU, email volunteer@imruradio.org. You can also listen to our podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Breaker, Radio Public, Stitcher, Anchor.fm, CastBox, and Pocket Casts. Remember, you can help slow the spread of the COVID-19 virus. If you have symptoms, call your doctor and stay home. If you don't have symptoms and can stay home, stay home. IMRU has been here for 46 years and will continue to be here to keep you company. Let's be alone together. Remember, an informed community is a strong community. Good night and stay well.